Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and as many of you know, all this month we're inviting you to enter your favorite local library for a chance to win a New York City Neighborhood Library Award. The awards honor extraordinary libraries by providing five grand prize winners with $20,000 each and five additional finalists with $10,000 each, sponsored by the Stavros Niarchos Foundation and Charles H. Revson Foundation. The 2017 nomination period closes March 13th, so it's coming right up. You can nominate your branch library by going to nyclibraryawards.org, nyclibraryawards.org, or there's a link on our website. And in conjunction with the awards, we've been doing a series about historical fiction, and we even launched our own historical fiction writing contest that you can enter with a very short story. Some of you already have. Our deadline for that will be March 13th, too. And this is a challenge where you write your own story of up to 2,000 words inspired by a historical audio prompt that we pulled from the WNYC archive. We have four different prompts that you can hear from our site and choose which one to write around. Here's one of them. In 1966, transit workers went on strike, bringing public transportation to a halt in New York City for a record-breaking 12 days. And in this clip, the famously salty president of the Transit Workers Union from those days, Mike Quill, gives a press conference to reinforce the unyielding stance of the transit workers.
Personally, I don't care if I rot in jail. I will not call off the strike.
And you can hear the rest of the clip and the three other prompts by going to the Brian Lehrer Show page on our website, WNYC.org. The idea is to choose an audio prompt and use it as a jumping off point for a story or a scene with a limit of 2,000 words. And the winning writer will get to come on the air here and talk about your story. So check it out on our page. You'll see the little tab there that says historical fiction. And last time we talked about this, we learned a little bit about what it takes to alter history completely with the author Jeff Greenfield, who wrote the book If Kennedy Lived. He also imagined a world where Gore beat Bush in 2000 in another of his alternate history books. Today we're going to talk about point of view. What does it take to write about someone from a different time? And who gets to tell a story? Who gets to shape history? With me now are two novelists, Caitlin Greenidge. Her debut novel came out last year, and it's called We Love You, Charlie Freeman. And with her is Christopher Bram. He's the judge of our historical fiction challenge and the author of many novels, including Father of Frankenstein, Exiles in America, and The Notorious Dr. August. He's also the author of The Art of History, Unlocking the Past Through Fiction and Nonfiction. So welcome back, both of you, to WNYC.
Thanks. Great to be here, Brian.
And what do you think about the idea, Caitlin, of who gets to write history? Who gets to tell the stories from the past? Do you think historical fiction is on some level a way to give voice to those who may have been unable to speak up in the past and tell their stories?
Sure. I think that's one of the appeals of writing historical fiction is you get to talk about stories that maybe not everybody knows about, or talk about a story that we think we all know about the past, but figure out kind of a new angle on it. And I think what's really exciting about writing about history in the past is figuring out how people in the past both thought in the same ways that we think, and also how they thought completely differently and approached the world completely differently than how we do now.
Because your story itself, your book, deals with themes of not being able to speak up, not being able to tell a story, right?
Yeah, I'm always interested in the ways that language both works for us and the way that language fails us or gets in the way of what when we're trying to communicate certain things.
And Chris, about identity, you've said that you've spent your life writing gay stories, and a lot of your books explore gay history in one way or another, from 1940s New York to 1990s Washington to the First World War to 1930s Hollywood. Your last novel, Exiles in America, looked at a gay couple at home during the invasion of Iraq. How does writing the gay story, as you've called it, change as the time setting changes?
Well, there are different rules. There's the whole gay identity, what is silent, what is unsaid. The trickiest time I wrote about was in the notorious Dr. August. I have a gay man in the 19th century, and there wasn't even a name for it then. And I thought, how am I going to write about this? Well, it just never came up because Fitz, the main character, he was in love with a former slave, Isaac. And it was all about love of Isaac. It wasn't about love of men. It had nothing to do with his sexual identity. He was in love with this one man. And that became the that's different from when I'm writing about World War II or, of course, even then there's it's a little more slippery. And then we get to the 90s and there is a real gay identity. So it does change in the centuries.
And listeners, have you read a book of historical fiction which has made you think differently about a story you thought you knew? Did you learn something one way in history class in school and then read a book of historical fiction that flipped the story on its head or in some other way? Call in and tell us about it. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And if you're struggling with your own piece of historical fiction to enter our contest, you can even ask our judge, Christopher Bram, for some advice. But Caitlin, your book centers around an unusual scientific experiment, an African-American family's move from their mostly black neighborhood to live at a research institute in an almost all-white community. The family is there to teach a chimpanzee sign language and to raise him as a member of the family while the researchers observe and take notes. And the book goes back and forth from the 1990s to the 1920s. There are so many questions I could ask you, but the one I want to ask right now is, how does the language you use to write about and around race change as you go back and forth through those two decades, 70 years apart?
Well, I had a lot of fun writing about the early 1990s. I mean, I think at least for me growing up then and thinking about my sisters kind of living then, early 1990s, there was a huge kind of rebirth and reinterest in Afrocentrism and African history, African American history, a huge push around African American arts and movies and TV shows and kind of all that kind of stuff. So there is a little kind of the language that goes kind of all around with that. But what really struck me between the difference between that moment then and kind of a similar renaissance that we're in kind of right now is that language was still borrowing really a lot from the 60s and 70s and wasn't really kind of bringing in a whole bunch of different experiences and ideas, wasn't really talking about class, really. It was kind of just sort of all of this very romantic idea of this pretend Afrocentric past. So that was really fun to play with those sorts of languages and ideas with the oldest daughter, Charlotte, and her friend, Adia, who are both about 14 or 15 in 1991 and very much taken up with the romanticism around that. And then writing about the character in the 1920s, this woman who goes by the name Nymphadora, and she's coming out of a whole other tradition from basically the language of Du Bois, the idea of the talented tenth, and she's both inspired and completely feels self-crippled by this idea of black excellence, that there's absolutely no deviation, that she's not allowed to mourn or be depressed or falter in any kind of way. It is just all about channeling yourself towards triumph, not only for yourself, but triumph for the race. And so any sort of personal failure means that you have let down your entire race of people, which is language that sounds very harsh, but is also true to the reality of that time of what you would have been forced to live in, mm-hmm. as kind of clinging to respectability and a middle class existence. So those two ideas kind of it was fun to find the parallels between those two types of languages of talking about race and mostly just talking about black identity, about how African American identity, how you are going to define yourself as a black person in America.
Suzanne in Maplewood wants to talk about a book. Suzanne, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi. I read Colleen McCullough's series, The First Men of Rome, which was about Marius, Sulla, and Julius Caesar, who I didn't have any interest in until I read the books and found out how fascinating he is, but what I got an appreciation for was the time that he lived in, and the things that he did were completely like our world today, particularly in regards to immigrants, by the way.
Hmm. And so you learned about history by reading historical fiction.
Yeah, absolutely. About that period of history, which you know, you hear Caesar, and I never cared until I read that book. I was like, oh, that's why they talk about it.
Suzanne, thank you very much. Chris, did you want? You look like you want to say something.
Oh, just it's kind of. I just finished reading SPQR by Mary Beard. Her look at the history of Rome, and she makes a really interesting case that what we think of as the Roman historical texts, Tacitus, Livy, are not terribly trustworthy. In fact, they're like novels, and she reads them as novels. So in a way, novels have always kind of given us a window on Roman history, which means we kind of project our own morals in there, or kind of we learn lessons from it. There's always been this moral reading of Rome. And she does a great job of saying that how much is uncertain, and we have to back it up with archaeology. And even then, there's no clear, solid answers. It's kind of fascinating that Roman history is like a historical novel already.
Yeah.
So Colleen McCullough can then kind of just expand on that. Robert Graves and I, Claudius, too.
Oh, I was just going to say, you know, Mary Beard, she is a historian, but she makes the fantastical point in a lot of her histories of how much of what we understand about Roman history is a small percentage of the people who would have been Romans. And so she makes the attempt to talk about what it would be like to be a common person. And so I think that's another way that fiction and novels really work, is that we can talk about the people who don't make it into a historical record, but who are probably living the typical existence of what it would have been like to live in that time period or in that society or in that time. You know, like there's that cliche that when people are talking about what past lives they would have lived, everyone assumes they would have been like the king or queen or emperor or Napoleon. But we can't all have been Napoleon. So what would it have been like to live in these different time periods?
We'll continue in a minute with Caitlin Greenidge and Christopher Bram, and we'll bring up the question of appropriation and who legitimately gets to write whose story as we continue our historical fiction series. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. If you want to be part of it, stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC as we continue our historical fiction series and our historical fiction writing contest. If this is the first you hear about it, go to our webpage. You'll see the historical fiction tab, and you can hear one of four, or you can hear all of them. They're all fun. Historical audio clips from the WNYC archives, and write a 2,000-word piece of historical fiction around that historical audio, up to 2,000 words. Submit it by Monday. Monday's the deadline, March 13th, and the winning entry, the writer of it, will get to come on the air here and talk about it. And we're talking about tips and tricks and the art of historical fiction and even some of the controversies in historical fiction with Caitlin Greenidge. Her debut novel came out last year and is called We Love You, Charlie Freeman. And Christopher Bram, who's the judge of our historical fiction challenge and is the author of many novels, including Father of Frankenstein, Exiles in America, and the notorious Dr. August, and author of the book The Art of History, Unlocking the Past Through Fiction and Nonfiction. And Christopher, we have a contestant who's starting to write a story for our contest and I think has a question for you. Rebecca in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks for letting me talk. I did submit my story already, and thanks so much. It was so much fun to write.
Great.
I really enjoyed it. But the question I had for Christopher Bram is, I am working on a novel right now. It takes place in 1873-ish, and I have a gay character in this novel, and he just discussed the fact that there wasn't even a word for it back then. And I'm wondering how one figures out how to be authentic about this. I know this character is gay, and she is going to let people know that. But how does she do it?
A good question. I mean, people would there were a little code words. I think there was something like, "Are you like that?" I mean, there was real as vague as that. I think the word homosexual was coined right about that time, but it didn't get into usage for another 20 years. So it's tricky. It's you might take a look at, you know, is it set in New York City?
It actually starts in New York City and it ends in Santa Fe, New Mexico.
Oh, great! I love that range. That's
and they're
terrific.
Jewish, if you can believe it. So
oh,
this is
even
a crazy
better!
Novel.
Oh, you've got a nice, really nice mix of things. Take a look at George Chauncey's Gay New York.
Oh, cool!
And that
okay.
might give you some. But I'm trying to. The period you're writing a little later. There were a few more code words like. Invert came in like around the turn of the century, but your period, no, there's no word really yet for
Rebecca,
it.
Thank you. I can't wait to read your story. Thank you for calling. Victor in Newark, you're on WNYC. Hi, Victor.
Hi, how are you? First of all, Brian, I love your show. I listen to it all the time.
Thank you.
And I actually was telling the lady on the line, I had my first novel, it was published 2 years ago, which is it's about the Newport Navy Vice scandal, which is a pretty extraordinary piece of gay history. And it's gotten amazing customer reviews online. It was published by Amazon Publishing. And
did you call to plug your book, or did you call to make a point, too?
Pardon me?
I said, did you call to – you called to plug your book. That's fine. But also make a point. Go ahead.
Well,
make a point.
The point is that there's still some resistance to gay fiction. I mean, I was supposed to be on a show. I was booked for a show on WNYC about a year ago, and that I was supposed to read portions of it. And I forget the name of the show now. And as soon as the guy knew that it was a gay story, he said, "I can't do that. I'm going to lose. I'll lose subscribers around the country."
I'd be shocked if that was true. Considering how much gay-oriented program we do and how much we embrace it. And so I'd really be shocked if that's true, but I'm very sorry if that happened to you. And, Victor, thank you for your call. I want to raise the issue of appropriation. For example, Michael Chabon's 2012 novel, Telegraph Avenue, set in 70s New York, shifts perspectives from white and black protagonists, and the book prompted articles like, "Can a white guy like Michael Chabon write about black characters?" And reviewers question whether he was trying too hard to sound like he was, quote-unquote, from the hood. A white New York Times reviewer even questioned whether she was qualified to review the book, but white American writers from Herman Melville to Harriet Beecher Stowe to Mark Twain to William Faulkner to Harper Lee – other people have pointed out, have been creating and inhabiting black characters as they would any other for some time. So can I get both your take on this? Is the current discomfort in this endeavor a symptom of our current climate of political correctness, or is it a long overdue discomfort? Caitlin, you have an opinion about this?
Well, I think the questions that are posed around it are usually the wrong questions. So like even that list that you just read, you just only read white authors who write across race, and of course other authors of other races and other orientations write across mm-hmm. all the time. And so I think the issue is not so much can a writer do it or not do it, it's what sort of critical response are they given and whose voices get amplified at the expense of other voices. Because we don't really like to talk about a question of power or a question of access to certain kind of airways or access to certain kinds of ways to promote or which kind of book gets to the top of the heap. There's only so many books we can talk about in a day. And usually those books are by white authors just because of the way, you know, for very many reasons, usually those books kind of make it to the top because of our larger culture and how we kind of orient our culture. And those things begin to change and shift over time. But I think the question is really sort of less, you know, is somebody allowed to do this, and more why somebody chooses to write for another character or not, and then also, you know, are they able to do it well? And then when we're talking about those books, what other books or experiences are we kind of leaving out of the conversation that could actually maybe be in conversation with those books mm-hmm. and make the experience richer for all of us who like to imbibe in culture and think about big ideas.
Chris?
Building on what Caitlin said, I think we have it's not so much a right to write about people unlike ourselves. We have an obligation to, and it entails risk. And there's a big question of how well do you do it? That's the really important thing. Mm-hmm. And otherwise, we're stuck with just writing about ourselves and our narcissistic selves, and that's not very interesting. But we take a risk and try to write about somebody of a different race, a different gender, a different century, a different country. And it's we're taking chances, but it's exciting. And we can do it while we can get out of ourselves. Minority writers who write about whites very well. I mean, James Baldwin, early on in Giovanni's Room, it's all white characters. Mm-hmm. And nobody criticized him for that.
Right, and that novel isn't talked about in terms of what does it mean to write about another race, but right. It would be really interesting if we did, right?
Maybe it's not a moral equivalent to say a black person writes about a white person than when a white person writes about a black person.
I don't think it's a question of morals. I think it's a question of you know, it's kind of like a really simple reduction, and listeners may disagree. But when you're writing from a position of privilege, you're already a little bit blinded because you're not a person who is at the bottom of a social hierarchy can see a lot more than the person who's at the top. And that applies to race, that applies to class, that applies to gender. And you can't get the whole of a situation unless you're looking at both views. And so the really exciting thing about being a novelist and a writer is that hopefully you're curious about both views. Hopefully you're curious about figuring out kind of the entire map so that you can make your characters come alive. And even if you're not necessarily writing about the character who's at the very bottom or the character who's at the very top, you have done your research and you've thought about these things to figure out how these characters fit into a wider world.
So we're just about out of time, but Chris, real quick, have you been reading our historical fiction submissions so far?
I have been, and I'm really enjoying them. Now and then there'll be one that'll be kind of top-heavy with information and historical details, but most of them they're lively, they're funny, they're very inventive. It's interesting, not one but two different people have written pieces. Mike Quill, the labor organizer, such a great character. Two people made him characters, and one of them had him go to heaven and argue his way past St. Peter. It was a wonderful
That's
piece.
Great.
So I'm really enjoying it. I'm
so
having a good time.
Listeners, you can enter until next Monday at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Go listen to those historical fiction prompts from our archives, and also enter your branch library in the NYC Library Awards.org. Also a Monday deadline, Caitlin Greenidge, author of We Love You, Charlie Friedman, and Christopher Bram, who will be back after we have a winner of the contest. Thank you both so much.
Great to be here, Brian.
Thank you.
And I will end today on International Women's Day with a shout out to some of the many women who toil on this show: Lisa Allison, Mary Croak, Zoe Agelet, Amina Cerna, Jenna Cagle, Justine Daum, Leora Noam Kravitz, and Megan Ryan. And our interns are Camille Baker and Rahima Nasa. I just want to say respect.